In this episode of Startups with the Rest of Us, I talk with Derek Reimer about what it's like selling a $128,000 side project. This is Startups with the Rest of Us, episode 311. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Derek.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So where this week, sir?
Well, I'm getting geared up for a real winter to come for the first time in my life.
Indeed. It's been getting chilly the last couple of weeks, huh?
Yeah. We had our first drop below freezing last night, I think. So for those who don't know, I recently relocated along with you from Fresno, California, out to Minneapolis, Minnesota. So I'm a born and raised California native. So this is all a new experience for me.
Well, I guess the highs have been in the 50s, which isn't bad, but when I've been getting to work in the morning, it's like 44 with wind, and realizing that it's going to be 50, 60 degrees cooler than that here in a few months is a little chilling, but it's been like, boy, I got to get the big coat out of the closet.
Yeah, my wife and I went out and bought jackets that can actually keep you warm in this type of climate because we're used to just our California jackets, and right now we've basically reached California winter status, and it's only October.
Yes. That's right. It's early October. Cool. So we're here to talk today about your recent sale of CodeTree. And so to give folks a little bit of background, you're Derek Reimer, co-founder of Drip. You were the CTO to my CEO, and we were acquired 3 months ago by LeadPages, as everyone knows. But during the time that we were building Drip, I have always had my little side projects, podcasts and conferences, and I'd hit tail going. And you went and built CodeTree.com, which is lightweight project management that lays over GitHub issues. And this actually came out of the need that we had internally, right? Managing multiple developers and prioritizing.
Yeah, we were using Fogbugs before we switched to using GitHub issues. And we were just starting to see the product wasn't totally actively maintained and it wasn't meeting all of our needs. So I really wanted to start using GitHub issues. We were already using GitHub as in a lot of our processes. And so looked at the idea of using GitHub issues and it was not quite there. It was about 80% there of what we needed. And it seemed like there was an opportunity to just build a little layer on top, something that would give us the ability to prioritize things and maybe view things in a little bit more compact manner. And so, you know, I looked into what it would take to do that. And then a light bulb went off in my head and I thought, you know, I wonder if other people are using GitHub issues in this way and need to do a little bit more project management type stuff with it. So it was right around 4th of July of just about a year and a half ago when I threw up a landing page for it and just threw it together in a weekend and started tweeting about it, ran a little bit of Twitter ads to push it out to basically the people on Twitter who are following GitHub so I could target them pretty easily, and immediately started getting a bunch of interest, which kind of set me off on the track of building it.
And were there a lot of competitors doing similar things at the time, or were you one of the early ones?
There were a few. There have been more that have popped up in the last year and a half for sure. And I did take a look at them and they all were kind of lacking exactly what we were looking for. So I had a little bit different vision for how it would work. Most of them were kind of locking you into a Trello style task board view. And so, you know, it wasn't quite exactly what we were looking for.
Right. And that's what I liked about CodeTree. So we, to give folks full disclosure, like this is still what we use, even though you don't own it anymore, we use it as it runs all of Drip's basically engineering prioritization. So all of our issues, bugs, new features go into CodeTree and we assign them out to all the folks who are working on them. We have our DBA in there. We have I'm in there for some kind of project management level stuff and decision-making stuff, obviously not pushing code. But one of the coolest parts of it, well, there were a couple cool parts. One is that you could do prioritization, which I think at the time you couldn't do in GitHub. And the other thing was the fact that I can look at a table-based view per developer. So the home screen for me is just each developer with a table of the first 15 issues that are assigned to them in priority order. But the developers themselves can just switch to basically a task-based view. I think you call it task list view, and it's like Trello. And so you can just work in that view. And that was like the ray of sunshine. It just made tons of sense to do that.
Right. Yep. So it was very, you know, very specific use case around GitHub issues. And so it was something that I felt like was pretty safe from GitHub building themselves. You know, I felt like this was a good, you know, alternative use case that would be hopefully pretty resilient against GitHub kind of clobbering what I was trying to do.
Right. And you figured, I mean, we had conversations all during this because you and I were in a mastermind with Phil, and we would meet every couple weeks, and we were talking through, like, you need to be agile enough to stay ahead of them, could potentially be an acquisition target later on, which is good. They very well may clobber you, but you got to think about, you know, innovating and doing things that they aren't doing.
Right.
And, you know, when you initially launched it, if I recall, I mean, this was before you had an ownership stake in Drip, and you were essentially just an employee of the Numa Group, which is what owned Drip at the time. And you were looking to grow this into like a full-time gig.
Yeah. Yeah. I had, I definitely had the itch at that point to have equity in something and to be, you know, using my skill set that I had built up over the last few years, building products and then working alongside you on Hittail and Drip. You know, I was really looking to leverage that into something that I could have ownership in. So I saw CodeTree as a good stepping stone. You know, you talk about your stair-stepping approach, and I felt like it is SaaS, which is a little bit more complex than something like a WordPress plugin or a one-time sale product. But I also felt like it was a small enough in scope that it was manageable for my first crack at a SaaS app.
Yeah, for sure. And this kind of was part of the reason we started having conversations about that, you know, because it occurred to me like, wow, Derek's really valuable to Drip, and you obviously had ownership and kind of a love for both of these products, right? You kind of had the desire to do them both, I think. And you were doing them both for quite some time. And I think you had dropped down to like three-quarter time with Drip at one point. And that's when you and I really started talking about, you know, what does the future look like? Where are we 6 to 12 months? And that really led to the conversation of, all right, let's talk about co-founder status. Let's talk about ownership. And you communicated well. You're like, I need to feel ownership in something. Like I'm a founder. I'm an entrepreneur. Can't keep doing this stuff forever and working for somebody else.
Yeah, there were like two conversations that stand out in my mind. There was a conversation we had right around the time when I was starting to build CodeTree, and you approached me and were like, all right, so where are we heading? You know, basically, is my long-term with Drip or is my long-term with CodeTree? And at that point, you know, you were looking for a commitment, like which way is it going to go? And it was a tough decision at the time. And I ultimately decided to continue development on CodeTree and forego setting that aside in favor of an equity stake in Drip. And then I think it was maybe 7-8 months later when CodeTree had launched and it was just starting to gain traction when we had a second conversation that ultimately led to me kind of doubling down my time on Drip and letting CodeTree remain a side project.
Yep. I mean, speaking of that launch, so let's give folks a context of how long did you spend developing it? How big was the list by the time you launched? I guess, you know, how did you do the launch? Did you just email everybody? What was the early traction? We can talk numbers if you want, loose MRR, or, you know, if you don't feel comfortable, that's cool too.
So I broke ground on at least launching a landing page in July. And
yes, you started marketing before you started coding.
I did. Yeah.
I love it.
It was the first time I had done that. I had tried building other projects before, and I, you know, of course, spent months building the product before anyone had even heard about it. So I was determined not to make that mistake again. So put up a landing page, got the early traction. I started running Twitter ads, and I felt like I could, you know, I could target the GitHub audience specifically. So I felt like that was a good medium, and a lot of developers are on Twitter, and managed to find some things that converted well. And I was gathering maybe 20 to 50 email addresses a day of just people clicking a button saying, yes, I'm interested in this product when it launches. And I had basically a one-page landing page set up that kind of described the problem it was solving. You know, it had a headline something like, you love GitHub issues, but you hate project management, and here's how CodeTree can help you do your project management in the GitHub flavor, basically. And so that seemed to resonate really well with a lot of developers. And I would say I didn't have as many conversations up front as I probably should have had, but I took the signal of like people clicking this button at least signaled their interest enough for hopefully a few people to be willing to pay for it once it launched. So with that bit of traction, I started development probably a few weeks after I launched the first landing page. And it really was a nights and weekends project for me. I was full-time on Drip. And so it took me a good 6 months before I was able to launch a early access. So I had a list of maybe about 20 people who I had more direct conversations with later on in the process. And I think I just gathered those based off of sending out an email to the mailing list that I had gathered through the process of running Twitter ads. And I think by the time I launched early access, I probably had maybe 1,500 people on that list. So a good chunk of people to start trying to get for my early access program. The response was good, but it was a good learning phase as as is most early access programs for SaaS apps, you know, I learned a lot about what things people wanted built. And I kind of had to come to the decision of, was I going to spend a bunch more time building full laundry list of features that people wanted, or was I going to launch what I had? And, you know, I think you, me, and Phil sat around mastermind meetings talking about strategy about this. Like, should I just get it out there, or should I try to build more features? You know, ultimately, there were a few 11th hour features that made it in. Like, I built a rough version of the task board, I believe, right before launch. But a lot of the things I just saved for post-launch. And so it launched in January. So I first landing page in July, launch in January.
Very cool. And then do you remember what the like conversion rate was to trial? And did you ask for credit card up front? I don't recall.
Yeah, no credit card up front. I felt like developers especially would have a big aversion to that. And the conversion rate, that's a good question. I'm pretty sure I got hundreds of trials after the launch, and I had a 14-day trial. So of course there was the waiting game of waiting to see how many of those would actually convert. I believe at the end of my first month, I had maybe between $400 and $500 a month in MRR, which felt like a big win at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a nice little jump kind of from a standing start, right? Because you weren't working from a network you had, you weren't working from an audience. You just kind of proposed an idea, landing page, and build enough of a list to hit that. And that, if I recall, like covered your expenses at the time. I think you were on Heroku and stuff, and maybe you made a little bit of just a trivial amount of money.
Yep.
That's cool. And then, you know, it was a side project, but you were investing time into a little bit of marketing and a lot of feature building for the next, what was it, like 4 to 6 months before we really had the conversation about Drip, and you kind of shifted focus and really put it on. It wasn't autopilot so much. I mean, you were still fixing bugs, and I remember you released some tiny little features, you know, stuff over the next 6 months after that, maybe. But how long was that initial, you know, kind of investment after launch? And then we can take it from there.
Yeah. So I definitely spent a lot of time, nights and weekends, building out functionality in those months post-launch. You know, I was trying to keep momentum going and also trying to address all the feedback that I had gotten from early access and from the initial wave of interest. So I think my wife could attest to that. That time was pretty crazy. We were still super aggressive on building out Drip. And so my days were filled with a lot of high intensity work. And then, you know, nights and weekends, I was spending a lot of time building out features and probably not focusing much on marketing at that point. I was really just trying to keep the momentum going from the initial wave after the launch. And I remember I took a work retreat where I knew there were some features that I needed to bang out, but I wasn't going to necessarily have time to do them split up into small chunks. Like, I really wanted to get some long stretches of time to get stuff done. So I think I stole away to the Central Coast for a few days and just like worked around the clock trying to hammer out some of those features. So I definitely tried to get creative during that time to get some big things done.
Cool. And then at a certain point, obviously, we had this conversation, and then you kind of made that transition, and it was doing a few $1,000 a month at that point. Is that right?
Yeah. I think it might've been around $2,000 a month at that point.
Cool. And then at a certain point late last year, it was funny. I think I had gone on a retreat or something, and I had written in my notebook, it was a bunch of stuff for me, and I was thinking about, and then I thought, you know what? I wonder if Derek should think about, he has enough revenue history, and I wonder if he's, you know, still kind of committed to CodeTree long term, or if he should think about maybe selling it, you know, and I wonder what he could get for it. It was kind of just this thought process. And I think at the next mastermind meeting, you brought it up and you said, I've been thinking about selling code. It was just funny that it had like both hit us at the same time. And so it was either late 2015 or maybe early 2016?
Yeah, I think you're right. Something like that.
Cool. And what was the process for you? Like, what made you the thought process? You know, why did you decide to sell it?
You know, I was feeling like the product had a lot of potential still. And I felt like I just, especially with my decision to double down on Drip, I didn't feel like I had the time to commit to it. And so the product was relatively bug free, and there was a happy base of users using it. I was growing by a handful of customers each month, so MRR was slowly ticking up. But there was still kind of an ever mounting list of kind of larger, high level features and directions that I could take the product to really provide a lot more value to the customers. And I just didn't have the bandwidth to tackle those larger things. And I knew that in the hands of someone else, it could definitely reach a much higher potential than where I was taking it. And also, you know, I felt like this can't last forever. Like, it can't, this market is competitive enough, and there's enough innovation happening with project management in general that CodeTree can't maintain its growth and its revenue in an autopiloted state. So really, if I am going to sell it, probably the right time was then, before the product started to decline.
Yeah, and if I recall, I said I would kind of check. I think I even checked anonymously. Didn't I say, hey, I'll talk to Tom Smale at FE and just check, hey, hypothetically, I have this friend who has an app doing this much per month and, you know, this much history, and what do you think you get for it? And so he kind of asked some more questions and threw some multiples around, and I think you were like, yeah, I think this is worth investigating. And so I made an intro, you know, between the two of you guys, and what came next?
Yeah, you introduced me to Thomas, and we talked back and forth a little bit. I provided some more numbers, and he came back and said, you know, I think this is a really strong app. There's a lot of people looking for SaaS apps in this price range. You know, there's a lot of people wanting a first app to buy, and many of their best ones are in the $500,000 and up range, which are just kind of out of the range for a lot of beginning folks. And then on the lower end, there's like the types of products you see on Flippa that are maybe $30,000 to $50,000 and not great code base and all the other problems that come with that. So he made me believe that, you know, CodeTree really kind of sits in that sweet spot, and he felt like we would be able to sell it quickly and be able to get an all cash buyer. And so all these things sounded, you know, really attractive to me. At that time, we were already knee deep in negotiation with Lead Pages, and I believe we were starting to near letter of intent and due diligence phase with that. So really all these things were compounding at once, and that made it especially attractive to me, the prospect of, you know, getting this sale done in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, if I recall, you know, you and I sold Drip, you sold CodeTree, you sold your house, I sold my house. did you sell a car or anything during that time?
I didn't, but yeah, it was definitely like a period of mass liquidation.
Yeah, it was such an interesting and chaotic time. But there was a feeling of energy. I remember us kind of talking about it, of like, man, it's good to kind of get some of the fruits of your labor, you know, or like to be able to take some money off the table, and also to feel, I know that it had bothered you for a while that CodeTree was there and you knew it was solid and you knew it could grow, and you felt like it's just a shame. I felt the same thing with Hittail. Like, it was like somebody should be growing this, and it's just sitting there. And so I knew it was like going to be a relief for you when it finally closed.
Right.
And so it's due diligence, but it's essentially like all the requirements gathering and all the numbers, right? The FE has a really intense process there where they ask you a lot of questions about MRR and where the traffic comes from and growth opportunities and all that. And how was that? And how long did it take?
I had been warned ahead of time. I think at MicroConf earlier that year, Patrick McKenzie had talked about his experience selling Bingo Card Creator. You had the experience of selling Hittail. And so I knew that it was going to be an intense process, but I feel like you're never prepared for that, for just the amount of in-depth questions that need to be answered. So preparing income statements and deep, in-depth discussion about what marketing has been done and how much has been invested in all the different areas to grow the business, and on and on and on. So it probably took a solid 2 weeks of time just in my off hours, compiling together information and pulling data out of Stripe and all the different places.
Cool. And then the sale happened pretty quickly. Is that right? If I recall, you had several offers or at least several highly interested parties pretty early on.
So FE likes to do an early access circulation of a new prospectus. So they kind of emailed their insiders group and tried to drum up interest that way. And I think there were maybe three interested parties who came forth during that period before it even went to the broader audience. And ultimately the buyers who bought CodeTree came through in that early phase.
Right. And for folks interested in hearing more about this, especially from the other side, the buyers did a really good job of putting together a series of three blog posts. The third one culminated in this extremely long, very highly informative article about all the terms of the deal and negotiation and all that stuff. And that's really why you and I are able to come on here and talk about it, and why, you know, in the intro or in the title of this, there's going to be a price. Otherwise, we wouldn't have done that. But they wrote a blog post called What It's Like Buying a $128,000 Side Project. And we'll, of course, link this up in the show notes. During the negotiation, you know, so once you had all the docs in there and then you started getting offers, was that stressful for you? Or was it, you know, compared to the Drip sale? I know that, you know, different orders of magnitude in terms of stress, but were you stressed or concerned, or I don't know, did you feel out of control at all with the CodeTree sale?
You know, I think I would have felt that way if I were handling it on my own. I think having David from FE International, my broker, who happened to also work with us on the drip sale, was really pivotal for me in just keeping a level head. He bore the brunt of circulating this to prospective buyers and vetting incoming
buyers and, you know, handling all the follow-up. So we would have discussions. He would say, okay, this is what they're offering. What do we want to say? Are you okay with this? And I could just give him back an answer like, no, I'm not okay with that. And then he would handle the whole process of thinking through the best way to craft a response to the buyer that would not totally tick them off or turn them away or whatever. So just not having to deal with those finer points of the negotiation really eased my mind. So it was in that first weekend, right after David had circulated the prospectus to the FE insiders, when I got initial interest from the ultimate buyers of CodeTree. And so we had a call with them, and that was a little bit stressful to jump on a call with potential buyers. You want to make sure you don't say something wrong or something that's going to hurt your negotiating position. So I definitely felt on guard with the first one, but, you know, David did a good job of kind of mediating the conversation and making sure that he jumped in anytime there was a question that maybe was not something that we were willing to disclose at that time. And so shortly after talking to them on a call, an offer came through. And, you know, that was a really exciting, just to get the first offer was a really exciting thing that, you know, we can talk about numbers, talk about what we're going to ask for it, but actually getting a cash offer was pretty exhilarating. But the cash offer was for $103,000. So it was way lower than what I was asking at the time. And so that stuck in my head where there was a lot of emotions around it. One, I was exhilarated, but I was also mildly offended, maybe, you know, that I would receive such a lowball offer. So I remember thinking I had to decide at that point, was I willing to take less than what I was asking, or was I willing to sit it out and wait for the right buyer to come along? And fortunately, David was there. I think I also talked to you about it, and everyone said, look, you don't need to concede it all at this point. Just wait. And that turned out being the right decision. But I think, not being a savvy trained negotiator myself, it's hard to think of, like, I'm going to just completely walk away from $103,000.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely shocking the first time you see that and think, wow, that's going to be wired to me in a few weeks if this all goes through. But I totally remember you were in such a good negotiating position because the app looked gorgeous. It was solid. It was well built. You had your reputation of quality from Drip. I don't want to say overshadowing, but kind of that CodeTree benefited from, because Drip is just a really respected product, easy to use and looks good. And so I don't know, there was just so much going for it that CodeTree was, in my mind, a premium product, and it was a low priced product, in the sense of, we see a lot of SaaS apps, you know, that come through and they're $800,000 or whatever. And it's like, really, you know, you either have to have a lot of cash or take out a big loan to do it. But to find an app of this quality in the, let's say, low six figure range, it's pretty uncommon. And so my gut was that, yeah, you were going to get a full price or close to that offer.
Yeah. And so it was fascinating to read the third part of the blog post series that the CodeTree buyers put out, where they kind of go in detail about negotiation from their side. And they kind of outline, you know, at this point in the deal, here was our negotiating position and here was the seller's, and kind of talk about how, I think as the seller, I was probably in the better position on this deal. And so it's really fascinating to see their thought process and how it aligned with what I was thinking at the time.
Yeah, there is just a dearth of solid SaaS apps for sale, period. And especially at this price range. And I know, I have several friends who have been trying to acquire things along this line for 12 to 18 months and are just, it's just not happening. And so it's definitely a seller's market today, in terms of, if you have a decent quality SaaS app, you can get a good multiple for it. Cool. And so, you know, you guys went through negotiations, you eventually settled on the price. As we said, it was $128,000. And after closing, did you get the bank wire right away? The same day that it closed?
No. So, okay, this is something, if you're ever selling a SaaS app, don't choose non-wire transfer methods.
So you went with the 3-day ACH.
I went with the ACH.
You?
And so that was, yeah.
But why did you go with the ACH, Derek? Tell everyone.
Because there was a $20 fee for the wire transfer.
There's a $20 fee. Oh, that killed me. I loved it.
And when I made the decision, this was like weeks before it was ever going to close, I'm like, you know, yeah, I'll save $20, but totally not worth it.
And then we got there. Yeah, you got there and it closes, and there's some stress or some anxiety through it. And you get there and you're like, finally it closed today. This is such great news. And you're like, I cannot wait to see that wire in my bank account. Like, that is the true culmination, and like that's the dopamine rush is when you see it. And you had to wait 3 days for it. It was terrible. I was like, oh no. And I think I was like, can you change that? Like,
right.
I'll throw the $20. And you're like, I totally want to do it. You know,
I tried,
but
I tried.
It was too late. Yeah. It was because it was escrow.com or something.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And it was already locked in. So that was funny.
Yeah.
And so then, if I recall, the next week you showed up in a Tesla, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you did with all the money?
Oh, man. I wish. No, I stuck it in a high-yield savings account.
Very good. Very nice place, sir.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think we've pretty much covered it. Is there anything else that you feel like we maybe left out of the story?
No, I think that covers it pretty well. And I think probably my takeaways from this, if someone out there in the audience is looking to sell their product, one of the biggest things is don't underestimate the amount of effort that due diligence is. And there's things you can do to make your life easier, like keeping everything separated. So I had a dedicated bank account for CodeTree. I had a dedicated Stripe account for CodeTree. All my other different SaaS things that helped power CodeTree were all siloed in their own accounts. And that made the handoff a lot easier. It made it a lot easier to narrow down the exact costs that were involved and where revenue was coming from. And I could produce a bank statement without having to filter out, you know, other non-relevant transactions. And so that made my life a lot easier. There was still weirdness with, like, when a Stripe charge comes in on one month, do you count it in the month where it happened, or do you count it in the month where the cash hit the bank? And, you know, you'll see in the write-ups from the buyers that one of their big issues during due diligence was this supposed discrepancy in revenue reporting. So some of these little things that don't seem big in the grand scheme can potentially hold up the deal. So
yeah, you were set up, you were really well organized, and that's kind of your nature. And I think it helped make this a less stressful process. When I sold Hittail, which was November, it was almost a year ago now, it was so, you know, enmeshed with other things because the Numa Group had all these products at one point that it was much more of a headache for me, you know, even to just suss out the numbers, the expenses mostly, because they were all commingled with things on the same credit card. And then the transfer over, it was actually in the AWS account that Drip was in at the time. So it wound up being a big mastering the actual transfer process. But yeah, I think that's a really good piece of advice for folks who are listening.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, if folks want to keep up with you online, where would they do that?
So you can keep up with me on Twitter. I'm at Derek Reimer. And I also have my website at scalingsaas.com, where I blog occasionally and publish other content.
Sounds great. And you've been co-hosting the Giant Robots podcast for a few weeks, right? I think you're on maybe a hiatus right now.
Yeah. So yeah. So Giant Robots is in its third iteration, and Ben is bringing on co-hosts to cycle in and out. And so I've had an 8-episode stint there, and it's been a great time. We kind of delve into the behind the scenes of building out SaaS apps. So we talk a bit about behind the scenes of Drip and also some technical things too.
Sounds cool. So if you're listening and you want to hear more from Derek, you could actually check out certainly Giant Robots, the last 8 episodes. I've listened to them all. They're very, very good. And there's more about Drip and other stuff in there too. And then actually episode 274 of Startups for the Rest of Us, you came on and we talked about how to mentally and technically prepare for your launch. And we talked through the launch of workflows that happened earlier this year.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Sounds great, man. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot. It's used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.